Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today, I'm going to be covering the murder of Hannah Windsor. And the reason I'm going to do this is because, as I've said prior to this, I want to give those people legacy. I want them to understand, wherever they are, in the big, beautiful beyond, that I did care about what happened to them, just as you care about what happened to them as well. We're also going to look again at some systemic failures. I feel like a lot of my videos are doing that at the moment. I think it's really important that we recognise where practice could have been better, where warning signs could have been taken seriously. And of course, the biggest question of all that needs answering is, how do we change these systems so that people do not fall through the net that can do irreparable harm and damage to our society and to individuals within that? Let's start talking about Adam Neil Lewis. So he was born on the 25th of February in 1994, and he grew up in Moreton on the Wirral. His upbringing was difficult, really difficult. It was troubled. It genuinely was. And if that wasn't challenging enough, that he was born in a scenario that was not enviable whatsoever, he also had what was regarded as quite significant learning difficulties. I think for anybody listening to this, you will understand that anything that adds complexity to childhood is going to add stresses, and learning difficulties undoubtedly can at times separate you from your peers, make you feel different, single you out, encourage a sense of isolation within the individual suffering it. It's actually long been established that what a child experiences during childhood can absolutely affect their well-being and their development throughout the rest of their life. So what is sown in childhood has a power to impact on, affect, and drastically distort at times how the rest of somebody's life will play out. There will be individuals who manage to surpass that and change that, and their beginnings will not denote their ends. But for a lot of individuals who struggle in childhood because they are born in the wrong place, to the wrong postcode, to the wrong parents, and have a whole heap of issues that surround that, add to that developmental issues, we know that the rest of their life is likely going to have some impacts, some damage, some fractures. As I've said, Lewis's childhood experiences mirrored that, and those experiences would basically manifest themselves in a personality disorder. And that personality disorder would shape his future character, and also, combined with all of these other issues, potentially shape a ruthless killer. I appreciate that most of you listening to this will have experience of people who live with personality disorders. Let me make it clear from the onset. A personality disorder certainly does not suggest that you are at any point going to do damage to another human being. In fact, in my experiences of working with many types of personality disorder, it is quite the contrary. My concern is for the individual suffering and dealing with that personality disorder, because they are not necessarily very nice to themselves or to the sabotage that they bring into their lives because of the chaos that's been caused for them by others in their childhood. Traumatic childhoods in particular relate to personality disorders like BPD or EUPD. But we're not talking about that type of personality disorder today. But as a caveat to make it clear to those of you with those issues, please appreciate this is not indicating for one second that you have anything but pro-social behaviours, and more importantly, that at times need to be more sympathetic and compassionate to yourselves because of the fact that you deal with trauma and you've been impacted by that trauma, and that has helped to develop a personality disorder that merely means that you cause yourself more chaos than you cause anybody else. So to be aware that I'm not at any point saying that personality disorders lead to this kind of horrendous story that I'm going to talk about today. Now, as a child, Lewis experienced some really high level neglect. He also encountered physical abuse from his parents. So this is a horrible scenario for him to be born into. And again, it is as far away from what we would expect a parent to act like towards a child. They should be cherished. So he is being brought up in an environment where he's being taught a really powerful lesson from an early age, which is you are not very worthwhile. You don't have that much value. If I can harm you, well, you're not necessarily even a human. You're an object that I can use however I wish to. Because of these circumstances, he ends up getting known to child mental health services from the age of 7. So this is really young for anybody to come to the site of mental health teams, because ordinarily these problems are manifesting because the vast majority of children in the Western world are in environments that make them feel safe enough and soothed enough so that these problems are not identified that early. Maybe down the line, but not that early. So from the age of 7, he's already scarred by these early childhood experiences. And add to that, he has these developmental issues. It meant that he suffered a degree of isolation. So his learning difficulties meant that other children didn't warm to him as they did other peers. And that's not because they were being cruel or mean. It's not because children are going out of their way to alienate others. It's that most human beings select what reflects them. Therefore, if somebody cannot interact or play or engage or even look to some degree similar to what we feel we are most comfortable around, then the likelihood is we will alienate them, because by selection we'll choose other people. So it isn't that we are choosing to alienate an individual, it's that we are selecting those that are more familiar to us and remind us of ourselves. But this means that he feels completely on his own. And his development that I've talked about was actually significantly delayed. So he didn't hit the usual milestones that we'd expect children to hit as they grow up. He didn't learn to walk or talk. He had poor movement skills. He struggled to learn new things. He found it very difficult to interact with others socially and emotionally because he didn't have primary caregivers who enabled him to grow and develop. And if you have a child with developmental delay, then they're going to need extra support and help. And as a parent, it's your duty and job to ensure that you do as much as possible to ensure that those goals are met. They might be delayed, but they're met. But he didn't get any of that. His parents were not at all engaged. They were completely neglectful. He didn't get any of the necessary support and stimulation at home. And that meant that he never really had an opportunity to deal with those issues. And of course, when we're dealing with those issues, the whole primary role of that is so that we can overcome them. Lewis didn't have that opportunity. When he got to school, they did identify that there were a lot of problems. It was established that he had a very low IQ. He had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and also a conduct order. So a conduct order is basically a type of behavior disorder. And this often manifests itself in social interactions, may disregard things like basic standards and rules, which is going to be problematic for people around them. It can involve acting recklessly, irresponsibly, sometimes aggressive and violent. So ultimately, that's not ideal, is it? When you're trying to meet friends, get on, be considered a good student, they're all going to cause friction. And it's just another way that Lewis is marked as different by his peers and also by his teachers, without a doubt. He had a really limited ability to think things through, so he didn't have the consequential regard for his actions. And that meant that he didn't know how to control those actions to some degree. It was also noted that he had a very little empathy for others. He didn't really engage with the way that people felt. It didn't mean that much to him. It didn't register, as far as he was concerned, whether somebody was sad or whether he'd had an impact on that individual negatively. Now, around the age of 9, Lewis actually does manage to basically escape, thank God, his horrible parents. You know, they were abusive and they were neglectful and they were certainly not deserving of a child per se. And the fact that he actually manages to get away from that is a really positive thing. He goes and lives with his grandparents, and let it be known, by all accounts, those grandparents, they tried their best. They really saw their duty as helping Lewis to get on the straight and narrow. But remember, the foundations that have been formed, along with all of the key issues that he faces in his world, there is a level of damage that's already been done. And trying to repair that is one thing. Trying to transcend it is probably impossible. But at least they go out of their way to give him an environment that is stable and loving and secure. So that has to be, in spite of the fact that this story is going to be one that is not positive, it still has to be recognised, because at least they did some work to teach him to understand that human beings could be good. Because I think that when we look at actions in the future, we also have to look about chain of causation. So we have to examine and think, well, okay, there are these real fractures in his childhood, and we're going to give him some credit that some of the actions that he then plays out in the future, well, okay, there is a level of sense to that based on the trauma that he'd experienced. And if he'd only ever experienced that trauma, I think we could all safely agree that as a society, he'd been massively failed, because it takes a village to raise a child. And when the parents aren't doing it, the school's got to step in, social services have got to step in, communities have got to step in, and that's how we remedy those kind of fractures. And we could all take a step back and say, yeah, this kid who was brought up in a horribly neglectful situation that didn't change ended up being what is considered morally wrong in the future. But we see the ingredients list of possibility leading to that moment. But that isn't his story, because he did have people step in, good people, who knew what he needed and provided the environment that gave him an understanding of what good was and is. So the excuse that I would have afforded him is diminished by the fact that he's taken in by his grandparents and they are really good to him. Lewis obviously grows physically, but his mental development still remains delayed in spite of moving in with his grandparents. And
step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to tracemineralz.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
Conduct disorder causes him to act impulsively and unpredictably. And also, he becomes what is considered in his community to be a dangerous juvenile. It's highly disruptive at school. It's not surprising. School is not an ideal place when you have learning difficulties. Unless you have loads of wraparound support, it can feel like such an isolating, abandoning scary, embarrassing place to inhabit. I think any of us can identify with that feeling where we struggle and others around us seem to thrive. It can make us hide, or it can make us figure out coping strategies so that they essentially deflect from seeing our struggle and owning a behavior such as being a badly behaved kid can somehow feel easier than being seen as a kid who just isn't bright enough to actually be able to cope. So the learning difficulties will no doubt have caused him to exacerbate that negative behavior. Now, a common trait of the person that I'm describing with conduct disorder is that they're going to misbehave. They struggle massively academically because obviously we have the developmental issues included here. He also, however, set fire to things. Now, this is a classic behavior of children who have suffered abuse or experienced really disturbed family environments. And it's seen in different ways. So on one level, you could say, well, it's a cry for help, right? It's a cry for help. It's letting people see this behavior is symptomatic of something that I am struggling with. Without a doubt, that can be one level of it, can't it? Notice me. Clearly, I need people to see that this is about some internal pain. But it can also be a way of satisfying a desire for power and control. When you have a life that just feels beyond your control, just having that tiny moment where you are all powerful, that in itself is going to be alluring. Remember though, arson, as in setting fire to things, it's often not an isolated juvenile behaviour. So when we see that in a young person's behaviour, it's usually part of what's known as a cluster of problems. And this cluster of problems will involve things like stealing, truancy, learning difficulties, hyperactivity, and also marked by troubled peer relationships, so struggling to get on with people your age. And these are all going to be a cluster of behaviours and issues that cause big problems. And Lewis's case definitely reflects it, doesn't it? Definitely. When I've just explored Lewis and his background and the way he behaves and also his developmental issues, he kind of ticks all of those boxes. But another thing about fire setting is it's also a precursor of antisocial personality disorder. Lewis also self-harmed. Again, this can be typical behavior of an abused child because often it's a coping mechanism, it's a soothing mechanism just to deal with unbearable emotional pain. So we're looking at a lot of red flags, we're looking at a lot of real pain, and we're looking at a lot of behaviors that undoubtedly on a social level are going to cause a great deal of alienation, isolation, and of course dysfunction from whatever environment you're going to be in. To add to this, shall we say, cooking pot of possibility, well, Lewis begins drinking and abusing cannabis at a young age. Again, this is stereotypical traits when we look at the development of a serious personality disorder, because anything that adds fuel to the fire is going to exacerbate any pre-existing issues, right? So if you add alcohol and drugs to a situation where there is already some problematic behaviours and problematic dysfunction, it's going to increase those potentials, isn't it? I think from what I've said so far, you'll understand that what I'm getting across is the warning signs were all there really early on with Lewis. At the age of 11, Lewis gets made the subject of a statement of special educational needs. That's a legal document. It sets out the educational needs and also how they're going to be met. This should have been something that happened at 7. It really is. Because when you're in high school, it's going to be a great deal harder. One, you aren't used to having people meeting those needs, so that can mean you don't know how to behave around them when they try. It can also make you feel like the spotlight is on you because other kids see that you're getting treated differently. And of course, the most important part of this is that early intervention has better outcomes. It's as simple as that. So it should have happened far sooner. And at this point, what they say is it's going to be better if Lewis's educational needs are met in a special needs school, which I think is a good idea when anybody has significant issues and they need more intervention, they need more professional understanding of what's going on for them, and there aren't the same numbers in class. That's got to be a good thing for kids. So he gets transferred to one of Wirral's special educational needs schools, and it's Claremount in Moreton. And it's here that he meets Hannah Windsor. So Hannah was from Birkenhead. She had had some problems of her own, you know, like Lewis, she'd been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And by all accounts, people who knew her said that that had caused her some really highly disruptive behaviour at school. She would struggle with learning. She would find it very difficult to concentrate. But when she had the will to do something, she would do it. There was a real determination about her nature, and she was very happy. She was very popular as a teenager. One of the things that was noted about her personality was she was somebody that wanted to be friends with everyone. She was a boisterous girl. She had a big smile, big personality. And her sister described her as the life and soul of the party. It's said that she loved music, had a massive passion for dance, and she was really close to her friends. So she was able to build long-lasting and great relationships, which is demonstrative of her personality and her capacity to engage with others in a really appropriate manner. She had managed to attend her primary school, Cathcart Primary School, and met lots of friends there. And then she'd attended Prenton High School, but she transferred to Claremount around the age of 13. She later went on to study dance at Wirral Metropolitan College because one day her dream was to become a dance teacher. But you can see from the picture painted there that we have a child who needs the same kind of special educational needs to be met as Lewis does, but a completely different mindset, a completely different mindset, and a completely different attitude towards life in general, certainly as well, an ability to have really good relationships. So even though she has similarities to Lewis, there are big differences, aren't there? Like Lewis, she had a really difficult childhood. She'd had contact with lots of agencies and organisations. These, when I researched this case, included health, education, social care, police, youth offending and housing services. So she really had been involved with a whole host of agencies. Now, when we get to February 2012, she's 17. And at this point, Hannah is provided with accommodation as a homeless young person at a hostel in Birkenhead. Don't even get me started on this. No 17-year-old should go to a homeless young person's hostel. No one. It shouldn't happen. It's appalling. She's 17. At the end of the day, just look at most 17-year-olds. They are not equipped, on the whole, to go out into the world and to cope in a homeless hostel. It's really, really difficult. One, because of the client cohort are there, and that's not me being negative about the fact that people end up in hostels, they do. It's the fact that it can be a very scary place to go. It really can. You can have a hell of a lot of needs in one space. And at 17, that would be very overwhelming to deal with. When she went there, what should have occurred was an assessment should have taken place at that point. And this assessment would have all been to explore whether she was considered in need and requiring local authority accommodation. No assessment took place. So at this point, we're introduced to what I would consider the first systemic failure. This is a 17-year-old girl who should be considered relatively at high risk because of her prior vulnerabilities, also because of her age and because of her gender. Nonetheless, as I said, it doesn't happen. Now, it may have been because of Lewis's and Hannah's similar backgrounds that they begin a relationship. This is about July 2011. I think it's really strange that Hannah didn't actually talked to her friends very much about the relationship that she was having with Lewis. In fact, her friends said that she very rarely spoke about him and didn't even disclose the name of the guy that she was dating to her close friends. Now, is this because of the fact that she's concerned about their opinions of Lewis? Is it because she's not really certain about the relationship? But there is something unusual about that behaviour. Teenagers usually are very willing to talk to anyone and everyone about new love interests. That's what we all do, isn't it? At the end of the day, when you get asked out and you start dating and you're a teenager, pretty much 98.9% of your time is spent devoted to thinking about that person, bragging about that person, telling everyone around you how great that person is, and so on and so forth. That's what it's like. Very temporarily. It's a very nice honeymoon period, that. And then you get a mortgage. And then you really think of everything else apart from nice things like that. Because life gets really big. Is that just me? I think it's probably not just me, is it? You know, your life gets swamped with a lot of responsibilities, and those momentary lovesickness behaviours, they just dissipate and they go to the very bottom of the list. Around the same level as things like, make sure you put the recycling bin out. You probably do need to feed the kids now. It's definitely tea time. And why is council tax so expensive? Those kind of things, they replace that gorgeous love area of life. Do I sound unromantic? I maybe do. Also, if you're getting married soon, don't worry, it lasts for a while. Anyway, all I'm saying is that the fact that she isn't behaving that way, it kind of makes me think that there was an uncertainty about her. Now, again, if you think about Hannah and Lewis's history, if you think about Hannah's own needs, her vulnerabilities, services should pretty much from the get-go of their relationship beginning have identified the potential risk of harm that she faced. Remember, we know about Lewis's background, and so do they. When we're looking at Hannah, she has the hallmarks of vulnerability. If there is somebody with a predatory nature around somebody like Hannah, she's going to be at risk. They're going to sniff it out. These risks were absolutely not identified. It didn't happen at all. And so Hannah and Lewis continue their relationship. This is about for 7 months before they eventually split up. And again, let's be aware that when you're a teenager, 7 months can feel like a lifetime. So we can't underestimate the impact on either. Lewis may well have felt that this was the woman of his dreams, and no matter how he treated her, that 7 months may have felt like a lifetime, particularly if he hasn't felt wanted elsewhere. Equally for Hannah, those 7 months could have felt like a lifetime of negativity. We don't know. What we do know is at some point she elects to split up. But, much like many teenagers do, they get back together in March 2012. And if only she hadn't. If only she had have gone with whatever the gut was in them splitting up in the first place. Because that reunion was going to be a reunion with deadly consequences. Hannah's older sister, Donna, actually recalled Lewis coming around for dinner. And she thought that he and Hannah were literally just friends. She watched him play with her child, her daughter, and seemed like a nice lad. But those perceptions could not have been far from the truth. But again, when you're a family member and you only get snippets of an experience with somebody who's come into one of your family members' lives, as long as they're on the best behaviour at that point in time, you're going to think they're a nice person. We implicitly trust the people that we love to make choices that are good for themselves. And unless you have a lot of time to witness things declining, or somebody doesn't have the wherewithal to act positively on that first occasion, then the chances are somebody can get away with being judged in a positive light, even when they aren't positive at all. Now, by the age of 18, well, Lewis is still living with his grandparents, but mentally, he had an age of about 9 or 10. So we're talking about a mental age of 9 or 10 combined with a personality disorder, which is connected to irrational and violent behaviour, because antisocial personality disorder is related to that kind of behaviour. He also, at a young age, got involved in criminal behaviour. That's another marker of antisocial behaviour disorder. He also had a number of convictions for petty offences, and these actually included 2 home burglaries, which I think is quite high level. I think going into somebody's home, you don't know whether they're going to be present. You don't know whether you're going to need to use violence if that's the case. It's just symbolic of poor consequential thought, high impulse issues, and also a willingness to put you in situations that could be threatening on both sides, shall we say, because you don't know who you're going to meet in there. So he must have had a confidence and an arrogance about him also that he felt it was acceptable to do that, even if it involved harming somebody in the process. So on the 12th of May 2012, things basically come to a head. This is after Lewis burgles the home of the ex-boyfriend of his sister, Danielle. I know. The thing about robbing somebody that you know is that it doesn't just leave a dreadfully bad taste because of the fact that you are willing to aggress somebody that you actually had some form of relationship with. It also shows that you have no care, consideration, or even understanding of boundaries. And I know at the end of the day, look, crime is crime. You have no boundaries when you're doing things that are terrible towards other people or taking things from other people. I accept all of that. But even the majority of thieves know that you don't burgle, steal, or do things to people in your network because it's your network. And the problem is that's going to cause perception issues of those that know you, and you're going to be ostracized potentially. But it doesn't bother him. So he burgles literally the ex-boyfriend of his sister. And that, again, puts him at risk to some degree, doesn't it? Because people are probably going to realise if there is a thief amongst you, the likelihood is it's you, and you're taking on a guy who may not be very happy with that scenario and arguably could affect you by attacking you. But we're seeing, again, there is just no consideration for any sophisticated thought at this moment in time. Probably as well because there isn't a capacity there, but also because he just...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to tracemineralz.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
Doesn't care about the consequences. He basically stole things like a BB gun, which we don't want somebody like Lewis having. But one of the other things that really provoked concern about this particular crime is that he set two fires in the property. So he set fire to a settee and a mattress, and that actually caused a relative amount of damage. It destroyed furniture. It caused smoke damage to other items, and yeah, no one was actually injured. But the point is, he could have killed multiple people. So this is an escalation. This isn't just about stealing. This is about potentially threatening life. At this point, the police warrant an issue for his arrest on burglary and arson charges, and they are serious. Arson charges are considered so serious that in the past, people have literally been sentenced to life because they believe that if you set fire to things when there are people around, you were willing to cause death and destruction to many. So these are not light charges. Lewis understands that there are going to be consequences when he realizes that there is a warrant out for him, so he goes on the run. And the way that he copes in this situation is to just go and spend several nights camping. This is in a woodland clearing on Bidston Hill. That's a really nice area actually near Birkenhead. It's basically 100 acres of heathland and woodland, and it's on the Wirral Peninsula. It's lovely. But obviously he also knows it's going to be more difficult for them to track him. He actually takes a Swiss Army style knife with him, so he clearly thinks that he's going to need it to survive to some degree. And he also actually calls Hannah and he tells her what he's done. Also, he tells her where he's hiding out. And I think that the reality of that is because he wants to see her. He's probably feeling alone, scared, afraid, and she's his safe place, so to speak. Hannah, at this point, does something that I think shows what a kind of human being that she is. She contacts the police. So as opposed to backing him up, as opposed to going and seeing him and just giving him what he wants, instead, she knows that this guy is actually somebody who is dangerous. And as opposed to just letting him get away with it, she takes the right route. She's pro-social. She speaks to the police. She tells them what he's done, where he could be found, and says, he's not a nice person. So again, we're given that insight, aren't we? She's telling the police he's not a nice person. So even though they've been in a relationship, how much of this has been based on her feeling that she had to be in that relationship versus whether she actually wanted to be in it? Were there consequences that she was feeling worried about if she ended that relationship? So she then agrees that she'll set up a meeting so that he can basically be arrested. So she's creating the sting, so to speak. The officers then take her details, obviously, and one of the things that they say to her is very clear, is do not see Lewis in the meantime. They're worried because obviously they know she has a relationship of sorts with him. They know that he's contacted her. They know this is a guy who's willing to set fire to people's houses and potentially cause destruction to life. They don't want her anywhere near him, and they're right. They're concerned about her welfare. They even give her a slip of paper, and it's got a telephone number on that piece of paper that she can call if she needs to contact them to have a conversation with them about this or inform them of anything else. But just like so many young people, and this is what young people, and actually it's not just young people, it's loads of people. You're given advice, you don't follow it. And you don't follow it because you think you know better, not because you're arrogant, not because you're stupid, but because you have a relationship with somebody and you believe that nothing that bad could happen to you if it's with a person that you have some kind of good connection with. So Hannah doesn't feel, in spite of Lewis not being a nice person, as she says, that he's a threat to her. And so she doesn't follow the police advice about not seeing him. Why she decides that she's going to see Lewis, well, that's something that only Hannah knows. But I think we can all assume that no matter what her feelings are about him not being a nice person, the relationship between them had some kind of importance to her. And without a doubt, she went to meet Lewis for one reason. She felt she was safe with him. It's the biggest mistake she could have ever made. She obviously feels that even though this guy has got all of this form, even though he's got a relatively sadistic nature, when he's with her, he's not a danger. And it breaks my heart to imagine that that police officer handed her that number, making her aware that there was help if she needed it, and also trying to let her know, you know what? This person is not somebody you want to be around. Do not see him. And for whatever reason, there was that overwrite in her brain that was like, yeah, it's cool. It'll be fine. It's just Lewis. How many people have gone to places believing that it's just somebody that they can trust? Even though there's a massive background of terrible behaviours in that person, but still, we think it's different if it's us who goes. It's different when they're around us. A lot of us have those beliefs and biases, and they are so deadly in certain cases. On the 16th of May, it's a Wednesday, she goes to visit Lewis. This is at the campsite that has been sleeping rough. She tells the mum that she's visiting a friend, so she's protecting him in that respect. And she's last seen by the staff in the afternoon, and this is at the assisted accommodation where she lives. She's captured on CCTV walking along a leafy path on Bidston Hill. That's on her way to see Lewis. Now, exactly what may have happened between the two, well, that might never be known. But it's suspected, as I'll tell you now, that Lewis found out that Hannah had spoken to the police. So it's a belief that he either made her tell him or even found the note that the police had given her. But something they believe sparked the reality for Lewis that Hannah, in his mind, had betrayed him. Again, we don't absolutely know that. So it's thought that Lewis was just feeling so betrayed and enraged by what she'd done that he exacted a horrific revenge during a sustained attack which involved brutal, sadistic torture. He tied Hannah to a tree. He bound her mouth with tape. Sexually assaulted her, he slashed her repeatedly with the Swiss Army knife, and then he strangled her to death. He then moved her body to about 25 metres away, and he hid it in bushes, and then he covered it with soil and branches, which is just a heinous thing to do, to just dump that poor girl's body in a place like that. You know, all she had done was believed that he wasn't the terrible human being that he played out to be. The following day, so on Thursday the 17th of May 2012, Lewis actually approaches a man. He's walking on Bidston Hill, and he actually asks this random stranger, what would you get for murder? Now, evidently, by this point, Hannah's already dead, so he knows that he would be up for murder. But a very strange thing to do, isn't it? Just go up and ask somebody how long you'd get for murder. It also means that he has an absolute conscious awareness of what he's done. So again, this isn't somebody who isn't aware of the actions that he's carried out. On Friday afternoon, this is the 18th of May 2012, well, Hannah gets reported missing by her family. She usually have contacted her mum for money because she didn't have any, and this was something that was normal. Her mum expected that communication. The same day that Hannah's reported missing to the police, Lewis actually gets arrested for the burglary and arson offences. He gets released on bail at this point because, of course, they don't know they're booking in a murderer. They think that he's being done for these crimes and therefore he's relatively safe in the community, although I'm not sure that somebody who's up for arson is actually safe to be walking the streets, but whatever, that was a decision that was made. What's really scary, though, is that when the police arrested Lewis, he was actually wearing the trainers that he'd stolen from the burglary, and those trainers had Hannah's blood on them. He's literally at a police station being bailed for these crimes that he's potentially committed, and he's got blood on his trainers. On the 19th of May, this is 2012, it's a Saturday, Lewis actually confesses to his sister and to his grandparents that he killed Hannah. Again, much like pro-social Hannah, Lewis's grandfather immediately contacts the police. At no point do that family try to protect Lewis from the reality of what he's done at all. Immediately, they just go ahead and tell the police what's happened. They also advise that Hannah's body was, quote, secreted near to the old observatory on Bidston Hill. So police arrest Lewis and they take him to Bidston Hill. They have uniformed and CID officers because they obviously want to commence the search of that area. And it's about 5:30 p.m. when Lewis leads them to the place that he's hidden Hannah's body. When the police, who obviously know that they're about to find a body, they don't have an awareness of what's happened to that body, do they? They're just going to retrieve that poor young woman. But when they actually remove the soil and the branches, wow. They don't just find Hannah's body semi-naked. They find her mutilated. It's clear from the moment that they lay eyes on her corpse that she's been subjected to severe violence, severe brutality before her death, which is just very traumatizing for those police officers per se, to actually see a body that was only days earlier walking around, laughing, communicating, having good relationships with human beings, to see that decimated this way is deeply upsetting for those individuals who find her. So this is a big piece of news in the area, because this is an unusual kind of killing. We're talking about the murder and mutilation of a 17-year-old girl. Whole of Bidston ends up getting cordoned off because police specialists and forensic want to make sure that they comb the area for every little bit of evidence. They are not going to let anyone get away with what happened. They are not going to let anybody plea that this was not sadistic murder. And they want to make sure that the absolute best is done to get the evidence to ensure that conviction. The autopsy was harrowing, I'll be honest with you, because when it established the extent of Hannah's injuries, the judge themselves would later say that when they read the pathologist's report, it made for chilling reading. He wasn't wrong, guys. He really wasn't wrong. Hannah had been tied to a tree. She'd had straps put around her wrists. Her mouth had been covered with tape. This is no doubt to stifle her screams. She'd been sexually assaulted twice. That was vaginally and anally. Now, whether this was by Lewis's penis or whether it was by a foreign object, they couldn't actually establish that. Either way, it really is irrelevant because it caused this really significant bruising and tearing injuries. Her urethra had actually been torn, and that was by an object that had been purposely inserted into it. And the outer lips of her vagina had also been mutilated and cut into. It was thought that all of the injuries to her genitalia had actually been inflicted while she was alive too. So she would have been present and aware of what was happening. When you think about those injuries that I've just covered there, we've all got to be able to agree that this means there was a sexual motive to this attack. You know, this was premeditated to some degree. He had certain items, didn't he, that makes you believe, well, okay, maybe he didn't initially think he was going to murder her when he called her to see him, but then he found out the information and then he used that to give himself permission to go ahead and do these horrendous things. And certainly the attack is rageful, isn't it? You can see the sexual sadism and violence. He's punishing her, but he's also enjoying what he's doing. Because if this was just about rage, if this was just about betrayal and wanting to end her life because of the anger that was felt, this would not be necessary. You would just kill the person. The fact that he's actually playing out some fantasies here demonstrates that within his nature, there is a sexual sadist lurking. And Lewis's actions were done to a girl who was completely restrained as well. There was no opportunity for her to fight back. She was completely helpless. Whatever he wanted to do to her, he could do. She had no ability to resist or defend herself from that attack. And without a doubt, he wanted her to suffer. He really did. And I think he probably took great pleasure in making her suffer. There were knife wounds across her body. They were caused by the Swiss Army knife. And also the blade had been dragged across her body, which left long scratches, long cuts. And some of them were actually across her breast. So again, sexual motivation. There is something about this sadistic attack that is ingratiating him sexually. She'd also been stabbed in the legs and her body multiple times, which had been unbelievably painful. And one was actually to the inner thigh, and that had severed the femoral artery, and that would lead to significant internal bleeding, significant blood loss. And one particularly savage wound was on her left thigh. Lewis had stabbed her in the flesh and then he had ripped the blade down to her knee. Can you imagine what that poor young woman was going through? The shock. She would have been absolutely stunned that this was playing out. Nowhere in her range of reference would Hannah believe that this was possible, that Lewis was capable of this. And after he's carried out multiple attacks, caused multiple injuries, it then transpires that he strangles Hannah. And there was evidence that he actually used his hands and a length of nylon cord. And this was found near her body. The thing about strangulation, particularly with hands, is so intimate, isn't it? You're often looking in that person's eyes as you snuff out their life. You're playing God. It's a way of complete domination. The fact that that individual knows that you have full power over whether they live or die. It's one of those deaths that always provokes that cerebral, visceral experience within me, because it's the knowledge that that victim is probably looking in the eyes of their murderer, the last vision that they have on this plane. And I find it one of the most diabolical deaths, because they don't just steal their life, they steal that last moment, because the only thing that that individual can look at is the person who's taking away their freedom and fundamentally their life per se. The pathologist actually established that the cause of death was basically a combination of injuries, which you won't be surprised at after what I've just talked about. Now, the most notable one was the stab wound to the thigh, because obviously it was massive blood loss and internal bleeding, and also asphyxia. So the strangulation and the fact that she had a tape over her mouth as well, which made breathing in impossible to some degree. And they also believe that whilst the vast majority of the injuries were actually inflicted whilst Hannah was alive, which is just horrific to even imagine, they also believe that her body did receive some post-mortem mutilation. At the crime scene, they also found that note that I told you about earlier on, the one with the phone number from the police, and that had been torn up by her body. That's further evidence, isn't it, that that was a big catalyst in the attack, because he discovered that note. He discovered that Hannah had spoken to the police, and it may be that that was all he needed. Maybe he was looking for an excuse to harm her. Maybe the reason that he had the tape and things to harm her with were actually because he desperately wanted an excuse. That could well be what we're talking about here. You know, the fact that she went there believing the best in him, and actually he knew exactly what he wanted to do with her, is a possibility. Maybe he recognized that he was going to go to prison. Maybe he thought that going to prison would be for a relatively large amount of time. So he has this fascination, this morbid desire to harm somebody, to carry out this sexual sadism. And so he uses Hannah. Again, it could just be that he was angry and the tipping point was seeing the note. But there is a part of me that thinks, wow, the kind of abuse that she suffered, the torture, the humiliation, the sadism, the genital mutilation, the mutilation of the breasts, that's not what you do to kill somebody. That's what you do for your own pleasure before you kill them. When the police interrogate Lewis, well, he admits to killing Hannah, but he doesn't admit to murdering her. He basically says that he strangled her after she attacked him. So, you know, the classic that we find in lots of murder cases, it wasn't me, it was them. It wasn't you, it was them. It wasn't me, it was them. But you're in the interrogation room and you're fine. I know.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
No, it's because I'm a ninja and I was just able to get away from them, and it came off worse for them, is what I'm saying. I'm pretty sure that what you're saying is you're denying murdering them, even though they are the ones who've had their bodies horrifically attacked and are dead, and are trying to instead blame them for attacking you, albeit that you have nothing on your body anywhere that suggests any kind of attack. It's a valid point. It's a valid point, but it's a point I'm going to deny, because the thing about me is, in moments of attack, I'm very defensive. So defensive, I have duct tape. So defensive, I have tape that I could, I mean, in the history of any violent situation ever, never do you have somebody defending themselves who just happens to have, you know, things to tie up hands and to put over mouths, ever. But nonetheless, this is Lewis cooking up some kind of victim blaming behaviour. So he makes some statement to the effect that she had been really abusive and violent in their relationship. Hannah, the really boisterous, likeable, lovely human being that everyone connected with and got on with. Hannah, the vulnerable girl, but that in no way, shape or form was considered dangerous. Versus Lewis, antisocial personality disorder, masses of dysfunction, lots of violent behaviour and criminalised behaviour. I bet this story was going down well. Now, I'm going to say this. Let's just, in the realm of fantasy where Lewis is living right now, maybe Hannah and him had got into an argument at some point, and even if she had hit him at some point, even if she'd punched him directly in the nose, even if she'd thrown something at him and it hit him on the head, even if she had acted inappropriately in such a way, even on that day, if she had literally met him, nutted him, thrown him onto the ground and kicked him in the cheek, that would still not justify what happened to her. You can't, and she didn't, but I'm putting it out there that even if by some bizarre stretch of the imagination, something had snapped in her in that moment and she had tried to attack him, not going to be hard for a man, not going to be hard at all to restrain a girl. It's not. He would have had the upper hand every day of the week. So this story is just that. It's a story that he's concocting. He also, because obviously now he's saying at the end of the day, I may have killed her, but it was by mistake because I was defending myself. He then has that extra problem, doesn't he? Because the police are like, as I was noting before, well, what about all the sadistic torture and brutality on the body? And he's like, well, I didn't do that. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, I didn't do that. You didn't do that. Nope, I didn't do that. I did kill her. I did bury her body, which is why I was able to take you to her body. But I didn't actually do the rest. I know. So basically, are you saying that after you had murdered her and buried her, somebody else came, unburied her, inflicted all these wounds on her and then buried her? Because in my head, that's what's playing out as would be required for such a story to actually have any bearing in reality. Which it doesn't. So on the 23rd of May 2012, Lewis then appears at the Wirral Magistrates Court. Obviously, he's charged with Hannah's murder at this point. He gets charged with two counts of assault by penetration, gets charged with burglary and arson. And the arson is being reckless as to whether life was endangered in relation to the earlier offence. At this point, Lewis does plead guilty to the burglary and the aggravated arson charges early on, because this is going to mean that he gets a lesser sentence for them doing that. However, he pleaded not guilty to Hannah's murder and the two sexual offences, which is bizarre because he is bang to rights. There is no way he didn't do it. But also at that point, it means that the family know that there's got to be a trial, and that's deeply traumatising. These people have lost enough. They're in pain enough. On the 21st and 25th of May 2012, hundreds of people, this is including family and friends of Hannah, they met in Birkenhead Park, Tranmere's Mersey Park and at Seacombe Ferry to release lanterns in memory of Hannah. The events were actually organised by one of Hannah's really close friends, Stacey Barker, and it's truly beautiful. It's always one of those things, isn't it, when it really sticks with you, that person's never going to see their meaning. I often think that when I've lost people of great meaning to me, there's that sense of, wow, I wish you could have seen. I wish you could have known. So often in life, people just don't recognise their worth. They don't recognise their infinite meaning to so many people around them. And then you see things play out after their death and you're like, you had no idea how much you were loved. And I'm sure that Hannah did know that she was desperately loved, but probably not to the extent that she was as far as the impact of her wide-reaching loss. On the 22nd of June 2012, again, more than 200 mourners turned up for Hannah's funeral. Her coffin arrived and it was in a white horse-drawn carriage. The horses wore pink plumes and mourners wore pink too, because that was Hannah's favourite colour. They wanted to send her off in a way that had meaning to all of them, a representation of her life, not the death. That's really important, to represent the things that she loved. You know, you can't steal that legacy. And when we lose people that have infinite meaning, we have to think about that legacy. Minister Suzanne Jones said this: it's important that through the sadness and disbelief that we all feel at her passing, that we remember the zest and adventure for life. Hannah saw every stranger as a friend she had not met yet. She had no boundaries, barriers. She was just born who she was made to be. What an amazing girl. She also read a statement from Hannah's parents, Peter and Gaynor. And they said this: please don't ask us if we're over it yet. We will never get over it. Please don't tell us that Hannah is in a better place. She's not here with us. Please don't say, at least she isn't suffering. We haven't come to terms with why she had to suffer at all. Please don't tell us you know how we feel unless you too have lost your child. Please don't ask us if we feel better. Bereavement is not a condition that clears up. Please don't tell us, at least you had her for so many years. What year would you choose for your child to die? Please just tell us you're sorry. Please just say you will remember Hannah. Please just let us think about her. Please keep on mentioning Hannah's name. And most of all, when we need to cry, please, just let us cry. Oh, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? So true. The platitudes that people mutter when people lose children or people traumatically or just generally lose people that they love. Sometimes it can be very difficult because people want to bypass the pain, just want you to heal. But the indelible mark the loss of a child creates is eternal. Nothing can ever change that. On the 19th of November 2012, that's on the first day of Lewis's trial at Liverpool Crown Court, he actually went guilty. Thank God. He changed his plea and accepted the counts of murder and the sexual offence charges. The only thing that we can say there is that at least that meant that Hannah's family didn't have to go through the trauma of the trial. And that's so important to remember, because Hannah's family are living the legacy of that loss. And the idea of having to bear witness to the pictures that they'd be shown, the injuries, all of the things in 3D, so to speak, would have been even more injuring than the agony was that they were suffering anyway. However, whilst accepting full responsibility for the crime, what he says is he basically couldn't remember most of it. Reckoned he'd blacked out, didn't have any recollection of torturing Hannah. Really? Really? Bit weird, isn't it? That you remember killing her, you remember where her body was placed, you remember all of that, but you don't actually remember the bit that makes you an absolutely reprehensible excuse for a human being. Oh, I just forgot all that bit. I don't believe that. For even a millisecond, guys, not a millisecond. Lewis actually faced a mandatory life sentence for the murder. And at the sentencing hearing, Hannah's family sobbed, because they had to listen to the horrific details of the ordeal that Lewis had put Hannah through. Lewis, on the other hand, remained emotionless, totally emotionless throughout. Yeah. People just breaking down, dealing with the harrowing extent of what happened to an innocent girl. And the guy who caused it? Yeah, well, can't remember it. That's his excuse. And let's just throw it out there. Let's just throw it out there that Lewis has a 0.00001% potential of not remembering what played out, how he tortured that poor girl. You would imagine when the details start rolling out that he's going to be impacted because, my God, I don't remember any of that, but that's horrific. And he's going to then break down. No. Totally cold. Judge Mr. Justice Holroyd said he had deliberately inflicted cruel injuries upon her, which must have caused her immense pain and suffering, and that it was a prolonged, merciless and terrible attack, which must have been agonisingly painful for Hannah before she died. Without a doubt, that would be the case. When you think about the injuries I talked about earlier on, it is just harrowing to imagine what she went through. Now, to be guilty of murder, there must be an intent to kill the victim or cause them really significant bodily harm. If the latter applies, it basically acts as a mitigating factor in sentencing, resulting in a lesser minimum term. Because obviously, you weren't necessarily trying to kill them, but the serious harm you inflicted did. Still murder, but there is a mitigation that you didn't actually premeditate to do that. However, in sentencing Lewis, it was clear that for the judge, there was no doubt in his mind whatsoever that Lewis had intended to kill Hannah. And this was because there was a mass multitude of injuries. Also, excessive force was shown, because you can see that, particularly the use of strangling her. That was massively forceful, wasn't it? And that was an aggravating factor in this case. And the other aggravating factors were the use of torture and also the sadistic elements of the crime. That's an aggravating factor. Again, so is hiding her body, or at least the attempt to hide a body. It's telling you that this isn't somebody who has acted impulsively and then thought, oh my God, I've killed someone, and done something about that that is important, i.e. call the police. This is somebody who wants to get away from the murder. This is somebody who's enjoyed carrying out the sadism. This is not somebody who has impulsively hurt somebody or didn't really mean to hurt them badly, but it got out of hand and then they died. This is absolutely somebody who wanted to take time to enjoy harming another human being in a heinous way. Furthermore, whilst the judge did actually acknowledge that Lewis had a mental disorder, he concluded that it didn't provide an explanation for his actions, because he said he absolutely knew what he was doing. He was very deliberate about his actions, and he did it deliberately because he wanted to carry out the crime. And without a doubt, he enjoyed it, didn't he? Now, the main mitigating factors in this case were, first of all, his guilty plea, although Wasn't it on the day? I mean, the thing about a guilty plea is it should really be done early on. Is it just me who feels that way? I'm like, oh, hang on a minute. We've got to the day of the trial and now you're like, oh, I did do it. Is that not more because you just want to get a reduction in your sentence? That would be the normal thing. I kind of feel like if you get to the day and you go, yeah, I am guilty, you're like, well, this has cost a lot of money for us to get to this point, and the trial is ready, and you did say you were not guilty, and now you're saying you're guilty, I'm not going to be lenient at all. In fact, I'm really annoyed that you've tried to manipulate the circumstance to your benefit until this point, so going down for life. Probably wouldn't be okay in shoplifting offences, but you know what I mean? Really annoys me that. Anyway, that guilty plea is a mitigating factor, even though it's a fairly late one. Also, his assistance in showing police where he'd hidden Hannah's body, that was a mitigating factor, because obviously it means that the family have her home. And his age, that counts in his favour because he's still a young man. Now, the usual starting point for an adult who commits such an absolutely heinous offence, that is a 30-year bar. So basically, that's the bar we're starting at, 30 years. If you're an adult, that's what you would minimum expect. But Lewis had only turned 18 12 weeks before he'd killed Hannah. Also, I'm going to be honest, in spite of the fact that this was the most barbaric crime ever, and I think that this is something that he really enjoyed doing, we all agree, from what we've heard about him developmentally, is that he didn't possess the same level of understanding as an average adult. So he doesn't necessarily have the same level of conscience, consequence, and understanding about impact as you would if you were an adult. And add to that the fact that he's got a very low mental age. Arguably, he's probably not processing the world in a way that people even of 19 or 20 are processing the world. On the 20th of November 2012, well, the judge ends up sentencing Lewis to life with a minimum term of 22 years. He's going to be 40 when he becomes eligible for parole. I don't know how you feel about it. I think that if this had been a case where a young man had murdered a partner in domestic abuse, and it had been a murder that essentially was more impulse orientated, accident orientated, where you could kind of blur the line and say this person punched that person and she died and it's terrible and it's tragic and it's definitely a murder. The point is, would I feel that they should spend the rest of their life in prison? There's probably a big likelihood that I would say to myself, no, this person probably can be rehabilitated with the right help. And as long as that occurs, will they be a danger to the general public? Well, most likely not. I feel really a little bit suspicious about this kind of a sentence for somebody like Lewis. He's going to be 40 when he gets out. So he's got a very long life to live on the outside. And this is somebody who got involved in sexual sadism.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Torture, mutilation, and murder. And he wasn't a little boy. Even though his mental age was problematic for him, he was still able to do things like home invasions. You know, he could think about what he wanted and achieve it. The fact that he's going to come out at 40, which means he's got the rest of his life to live on the streets around women, that does disturb me a little bit. And for Hannah's family, of course, well, they get to serve a full life sentence. I mean, they're every day for the rest of their life is going to be serving this loss. And that in itself feels very unfair. 40 is so young, isn't it? And the fact that we're talking about a young man who went out of his way to grossly and sadistically mutilate a young woman's body before she was murdered, and took some pleasure in the mutilation of her genitalia, that to me shows a great rage towards women. And I'm not sure that the prison system is going to allow for that to shift and change that much at all during that period of time. I guess it's important in this case particularly to look at Lewis's psychology. So without a doubt, all of the ingredients of a serious antisocial personality disorder were present. We see indications, don't we, of a sociopathic mindset. And those sociopathic mindsets would have been formed through his life experiences. He had a seriously neglected and physically abusive childhood. He had an obsession with starting fires, drug and alcohol abuse from a young age. He had a low IQ, delayed development, and he had learning difficulties, behaviour issues that were played out at school. He was violent and aggressive, at least had tendencies to be violent and aggressive, very impulsive, incredibly reckless behaviours from an early age. He was criminalised from a young age. He also had this complete lack of empathy, lack of remorse. He couldn't recognise consequences. It was an inability within his makeup to be able to do that. And whilst, of course, many people who've experienced similar adversities will actually just go on to be massively pro-social human beings who are a great benefit to our society, others with this kind of background and makeup, they go down a very different path, you know, a dark path. Lewis is a case in point. Even though I've said that, even though I've kind of gone through all of the markers that form this particular individual, still quite striking, isn't it? The escalation part of this. I mean, when you look at his background, you know, property offences, setting fire to things, to suddenly this brutal torture murder of a young woman, very unusual. That kind of escalation. It's really scary because, again, there's no warning, is there? And following Hannah's horrific death, there was a serious case review, and the serious case review actually recommended 111 separate changes into procedures that the agencies that dealt with her should carry out. Yeah, 111. So it concluded that whilst her murder could not reasonably have been foreseen, of course it couldn't have, like I said, the escalation itself, for anybody to go from somebody who's a home invader who's doing petty crime to somebody who can sadistically torture and murder a girlfriend stroke ex-girlfriend, that isn't something that most people could ever imagine playing out. What it did feel was that the service provision by the professional agencies that were looking after Hannah should have been better. They said that it was diffused, it lacked coordination, and that these meant that the potential opportunities to notice things that might have been problematic for Hannah in her life were missed out. So despite her involvement with multiple agencies, multiple organisations during a really short life, let's be honest, she was only a young girl when she was murdered, and yet she'd had this whole host of connection with all these agencies and organisations. The actual report itself said that there was no multi-agency holistic assessment of her needs. So they weren't looking at her needs, her characteristics and behaviours, and connecting what needed to happen in her life. In particular, they said that there was an overall failure to recognise the extent of her vulnerabilities and the significant consequences or the adversities that she'd experienced in life. Furthermore, they said that no child protection plan had ever been properly formulated. So when they're looking at those contributory factors, there are many leading to the reality that Hannah faced, which was that there was not advice and guidance, appropriate intervention, opportunities for her to think about what was playing out in her life to a degree where she could have questioned what she was doing, even that day when she went and met Lewis. And we appreciate the police have said, don't get in contact with him. But remember, as far as she was concerned, in her naivety and vulnerability, she thought that she was safe around him. If the right kind of actions had been taken by the agencies who were meant to be a foundation of support for her, the story could have been different. It could have been, like I said, I agree, and it's clear that no one could have premeditated that Lewis was going to do what he did. But if you equip somebody with the right amount of information and education, sometimes the decisions that they make are different, such as in this case, Hannah may not have gone. On the 15th of October 2015, the amazing family, the amazing friends of Hannah, well, they held a vigil. It would have been her 21st birthday, and they gathered in Birkenhead Park, and they released lanterns and balloons and just all showed up to remind the family and one another of how important Hannah was. Adam Lewis, he remains incarcerated. And you know what? He has never given any explanation whatsoever. Not one tiny explanation for why he horrifically tortured and why he eventually murdered Hannah. And you know what else? He's never, ever shown any remorse. And I think that's what bothers me most about this case in particular, because Lewis is going to be walking our streets when he's 40 years of age. But he's shown no remorse. He's taken no responsibility or accountability. He hasn't acknowledged the loss of life he caused, the sadistic torture he bestowed on an innocent young woman. He hasn't recognised the hole in the world he created for the friends and family of Hannah. He's just serving his sentence. Add to that, that in the violent male offender population in prison, 31% meet the psychopathy scale. And without a doubt, Lewis meets it. Will 22 years amongst such people result in a pro-social, reformed man? Or will it mean that Hannah's death never really got the apology that it required, and that a man who is dangerous with a potential for sadistic torture and murder will be walking our streets again, still a young man, still with strength, capacity, opportunity, in a world full of people with vulnerability? And that's a question that I pose today, because certainly it makes me feel deeply uneasy. Because if you cannot acknowledge what you have done, well, then you cannot change what you don't acknowledge. And I think that Lewis is safer locked up than he ever will be walking our streets. Anyway, let me know your thoughts. Maybe you do feel that people like Lewis can be fully rehabilitated, can come back into society and live pro-social lives. Maybe you're more like me, on the fence where that's concerned, want to believe that the best outcomes are possible, but in certain circumstances, particularly in circumstances like this, it's almost impossible to imagine that that will occur and that Lewis will actually be somebody that's positive in our society. And also what that does for the family. How will Hannah's relations and friends cope knowing that when they live a life sentence, he gets to live the rest of his life freely in a society that he betrayed so devastatingly? That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.